It may be invisible to some or ever present to others, but trauma entangles us all. Welcome to Traumatize, brought to you by Volare. Traumatize is a podcast that creates space and conversations to untangle the societal knots that keep us from addressing trauma after crime. For you, we want this podcast to be an experience, one where you leave understanding how you can be a crossing point to minimize the deeply painful and costly consequences of trauma, no matter who you are.
Welcome back to Traumatize, where we believe trauma is a common thread of the human connection. I'm Bridget Stumpf, and I'm here with my co-host, Lindsay Silverberg.
Hi, everybody. Today, we're honored to be joined by Adaku Uta. Adaku's work sits at the intersection of healing, movement building, and ancestral memory. For over 20 years, they've been asking the guiding question of how do we create lives and movements rooted not in burnout or violence, but in care, connection, and collective survival. Born in Baltimore and raised in Nigeria, Adaku is an Igbo queer non-binary healer and organizer grounded in lineage of farmers, healers, and community caretakers. Their work weaves together somatics, ritual, and healing justice, inviting people to listen to what the body remembers and to imagine liberation as something we practice in everyday life, not just something we reach for in the moments of crisis.
Adaku works alongside organizers and communities navigating grief and generational trauma, supporting movements to be not only effective, but sustainable and deeply humane. Rather than treating healing as something private or individual, they approach it as a shared responsibility, one that lives in our bodies, our relationships, and our lineages. Your work and the idea that exhaustion is inevitable, and instead really thinking that we should be asking what becomes possible when care, dignity, and connection are built and how we organize and how we live together is so beautiful and meaningful. And Adaku, we're so just privileged and happy to have you joining us today in this conversation. Thanks for being here.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you both for creating this space in this circle to be in dialogue about our connections, the connections amongst us. Trauma is one of them, and also how we heal and how we set ourselves free. So this is one of my favorite things to nerd out about.
We love nerding out.
Yes. Shout out to all the nerds. Yeah, it's a gift to get to be connected.
So this season, we're really trying to uncover how trauma embeds invisibly through things like epigenetics, family systems, cultural silences, and how resilience can transmit through awareness and connection. When you think about trauma in social movements and communities, where do you see it living and breathing, but you know, maybe beneath the surface or in ways that might go unnamed?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to shout out to anybody that's listening right now that's a part of movement, anyone that's actively working to shift our collective axis towards more freedom and justice for our people, whether you're a parent or an organizer or a cultural worker or healer. We literally need each other to survive right now and to make sure that our movements are sustained for generations. And I think a lot of trauma lives from the conditions that we live in, and also simultaneously living in those conditions and then actively working to transform those conditions, whether it's the conditions of authoritarianism, climate collapse, the deep amounts of isolation that's come from more highly technological world, or the isolation that comes from forced migration. So I see trauma and movements as what happens when we experience harm, not just from the state, but also the ways that we can adopt ways of relating that become more violent. And then we start to turn that on each other. And the breeding ground for trauma grows when we don't have the relational support or the collective capacity to process, heal, and build power together. And this can show up in so many ways. Like, I think it shows up in some of our movements, seeing every single thing that we do as urgent. Things are very urgent. I want to make that clear. And not everything is urgent, but we move at a pace that leaves our bodies behind or actually starts to harm more of us, and move away from the kinds and qualities of connections that we need to organize together. I see it in the ways that conflicts can become really harmful in erasing and disposing of our people, or the way that burnout has become normalized in some circles, or even the ways that we're silent around harms that we need to name out loud and be in principled struggle together. And so that might show up not just on like a movement-wide level, but obviously it shows up in our bodies. I'm somebody who I've been in movement since I was 19. I am going to be 42 in April. Shout out to the Aries. You know, I've had fibroids. I come from a generation of women who've had fibroids. And my last fibroids that I had that were removed surgically were 15 pounds. Like I was pregnant, 6 months pregnant, and they grew the most when I was working at a pace and inside of conditions that were just consistently harming my body, and I wasn't resourcing. I didn't feel as resourced inside of the communities that I was a part of. And so there are very real impacts of trauma on not just our movements, but also individuals who are also part of the fractals that make up movements. I also want to say that another way that I've seen it show up is when we have really unclear roles and, you know, our organizations are trying to do every single thing without a clear focus, without clear strategy for how we win right now. And our energy is just kind of scattered and overextended and really shallow, that we lose the depth necessary to earn the trust of our people, to last long term, and to also just keep bringing our people alongside with us. So I don't necessarily think that the presence of trauma in movements is necessarily a failure. I think it's an opportunity for us to be asking ourselves a set of really important questions around, like, how do we do our work in a way that creates more interdependence and less violence? How do we build more care rather than punishment? How do we decipher our strategies in this moment so that we can be more cohered and coherent? And yeah, what does it take to build lasting power that doesn't leave any body our own?
Oh, you're bringing up so many things for me. And I'm even thinking about the way, and so for our listeners, before we started, the way that you paused and just took a moment before we moved into the recording, I think I was like, that really struck something to me, like, oh, that's so beautiful to like sit for a minute and just feel ready. This idea of urgency, you know, is so by design, right? Like when we talk about, right, it's a condition of white supremacy, like this idea of needing everything to be urgent. And I would say within probably movements and the nonprofit sector, it is such a condition we have built and continue to sort of perpetuate of how things have to happen with urgency. And there is really something beautiful and almost like a resistance to slow down and be clear.
Yeah. And, you know, I just want to honor the parts of us that want to be urgent. Like, there's a lot to be urgent.
You're speaking Bridget's love language.
Yeah. You know, our people are suffering. We are being told on a daily basis, especially for somebody like me, who's a queer non-binary person, we are told that our bodies are not our own. The ice caps are melting. So, you know, I think the urgency comes from a really wise place. And so I want to honor that. And I also want to honor that our bodies are abundant. Like, urgency is not the only move that we have. And I think there is a question around pace. And sometimes we do have to slow down. And I think sometimes we have to pick things up. And for me, the question is more of, what's the pace that allows us to move towards freedom? What is the pace that will allow us collectively to move towards freedom? And I think sometimes that means like slowing down. I think about even the pause that I took at the beginning. I have learned to move very, very fast for a lot of reasons. It's also part of my fiery nature. And I often find that when I move faster than when I'm ready, I lean towards dishonesty, meaning that I kind of override my body's natural responses. And I will pick something that has been normalized in me that might not be true. Yeah, that's a practice that I'm trying to integrate. And I think that in a lot of our movements, actually what makes our movements really powerful is that we pause long enough to listen to where the harm is. You know, we listen to our neighbors around, our neighbors are not hungry, or like they need childcare, or they need hormones to support trans care. Like, we pause long enough to listen so we know how to build the campaigns that our people need. So it's fundamental. Urgency is necessary. It comes from a place. It's also a very capitalistic way of existing in the world. And so I think we need to keep discerning, okay, when is it necessary to be urgent? And is this urgency freeing us or is it harming us?
I want to jump in. It's actually not even my turn to speak.
Jump in.
You're bringing up something I think is like so deeply profound. What you said about when we rush, we're not as honest. Like, I don't know that I've ever actually thought about the impact, right? But as soon as you were describing that, I was like, I've had that moment. I've done
it. You're like, I was lying.
Right. And it's like some of the urgency is like the thing we're focused on feels more important than being, and that's not true, but that's what it feels like. And some of it is like, we're more, for me, I'll speak for myself. Some of it for me is like, I am more willing to not be honest with what I need and want if it feels like it's accomplishing what the person needs from me, right? The receiver of all of that. And there's something in this feedback loop that you're bringing up for me. And the words you used were sort of like when the breeding ground or the conditions that allow trauma to be present, to thrive and grow, right? Like all of the conditions where people are exposed and experience trauma. Some of this urgency tendency, when Lindsay joked, like, I have a fast cadence when I speak, I move quickly. Like, it's just like you describe it, like it's a part of my fabric, right? Of who I am. And so much of it, I believe, comes from my own lived experiences where I developed the story that when I move quickly, I can prevent harm. I can see patterns that are not safe more quickly. I can solve problems, right? Like it almost became like an adaptive coping thing to do things really quickly and feel more almost like in control of avoiding harmful situations. And it also can create a lot of harm, right? This sense of urgency that I bring into like
everything.
Like I'm a leader. I'm a mom. And like sometimes this really hit home for me. And I promise I'll get us back on track. We play this game with my kids called like, how well do you know your family? And there's little cards and it's really fun and they love it. And the question was, what is my deepest fear? And my children without pause said being late. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I am so rushed around, like we have to respect everyone's time. Being late is about respecting other people's time, right? And for them to see like, wow, mom really rushes around these things. And that sense of urgency that they experience because of that deep fear I have shows up in the way I lead and the way I'm in relationship. And so anyways, I didn't mean to turn this into a like full on processing session, but that is like one of the most profound ways of thinking about my own behavior that I've never had the words for until you described it that way. So thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I think you're offering like a really important invitation for listeners to just notice like, what are your patterns around urgency? Where did it come from? What are the roots of it? Is it serving? You know, sometimes, especially as people who are, if you're leading an organization, there are moments where we have to pick up the pace and move fast. There are times when we should not be late, you know, because that elder is waiting for us. We were going to be there at 4 o'clock. We're going to be there at 4 o'clock, you know, and then, yeah, when does it become an overarching fear that runs your life in ways that it shouldn't? So I think it's a really important, like a constant reflection point that we can be in around. And less of the focus on urgency, but for me, it's like, what is the pace? Like, what is the pace that this moment, these people, this depth of connection requires right now? And how can we figure out how to practice into that pace?
That's fascinating.
It's wild.
These conversations are always so amazing because I think it gives us pause to be able to, like, to your point, sort of stop and think about the ways that we live every day.
Every day. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking about for listeners who might be sort of newer to this understanding of somatics or healing justice, like what does it mean to approach trauma as something that's held in our body, held in our lineages, in movements, and not just this idea that it's in our individual minds?
Yeah. Such a good question. I feel that one of the consequences of living in a capitalistic world is that we separate the mind from the body. Like the mind is a part of the body. Well, the body gets objectified in order to produce for capital and for empire. And then the body also gets fragmented into these parts that then we place in a hierarchy. Like the intellect and the mind is more important than the heart and the gut. emotions shouldn't matter. They get in the way. And I think one of the ways that we actually reclaim that is just honoring that we are a whole ecosystem that doesn't move in isolation. Like, we are also part of the earth body. We exist because the earth exists. The earth exists because we exist. And if you even just like look at the way that you as a child were able to learn how to walk, or if you don't walk, any function that your body knows how to do, you learned from either something in your DNA that was passed down, or you learn from your environment. And when I sit with that, I feel so utterly grateful that I'm not alone, you know, and that this lie that capitalistic systems and also imperialism tries to feed to us over and over again, that we're separate, which is an illusion that creates disconnection from our people and our power. But we literally are alive because of the lineages that we come from, because not just because somebody gave birth to us and they passed on a set of traits. I think about, you know, both of my parents who are war survivors of the Biafran Civil War, where Igbo people are people, over 2 million Igbo people were killed at the hands of genocide. And my parents were able to survive that war because of ecosystems of care that they were a part of. And what they learned about survival in those times lives in my body. Like, I am hyper organized. You know, that's like one way it shows up, is like being very organized as a person. Or when I am afraid, I sing. And that's something that my grandmother used to do. I remember doing it as a kid, and my mom looked at me and was like, how did you learn how to do that? She's like, your grandmother used to do that. And I think a lot of us, I would even argue that all of us have something in us that comes from a people, not just the way that we physically look, but our instincts, the ways that our blood has learned how to congeal. And even from the oceans that we grew around, like the mountains impact the way that we breathe. And so all that to say is, like, we are a living testimony of what it means to be held in a full body that not just includes us, but includes lineages of people that we're either connected to via blood or chosen, or movements that literally have organized to make sure that we can vote, that we can afford food, that we can work. Some of us can work 5-day work week. All of us are alive because of the aliveness all around us, you know, in the body, in our lineages, in our movements.
That's so beautiful, Adaku. I'm like, this thoughtfulness that you use to describe some of these like pretty complex concepts, right? Like, why do we bifurcate the mind and the heart, and like the mind and the body? It's just like really interesting how that shows up. I'm thinking about how that shows up in leadership. And I was like, we needed you to be in the leadership meeting we were having at 11 right before. Seriously, we're presenting this whole thing on like how a survivor having excellent support translates into community trust, translates into investment and resources, translates into our own individual energy. And you even use the word energy, like this, like, I don't even know what the word is. It's like a tension that we see between urgency and energy, and like how they pull on one another, and then how efficiency in our systems and in our relationships alleviates some of that tension, right? Like, when our clients get the most excellent services, it's because our advocates and our therapy teams and our lawyers have really efficient supports around them to do their job, right? Really well, without that sense of urgency. Anyways, I'm going way off topic because this is so
connected. It's all connected, I feel.
So connected. It's so connected to what we're thinking about right now in our organization and leadership, and kind of who we want to be and how we lead. It's just very personally resonating in a way that's really beautiful. And I know you're open about your own experience in being a survivor. And obviously, this is the work that we do, is really listening to how survivors are best supported, what they need, and what we can do to minimize the deeply costly consequences, right, of trauma on survivors and communities. And while also being open about that, you hold these really beautiful spaces for others. And I'm curious how you navigate caring for yourself with your own lived experiences and identities, and also staying really present in creating this kind of collective community healing at the same time.
Yes. Shout out to all the survivors. And, you know, all the ways that we are still figuring out how to survive. And I use that word phrase intentionally. I'm still figuring out how to survive and care for myself. And I hope even when I am 90 years old, that I can say that I'm still learning who Adaku is and what I need to survive, what I need to feel cared for. I think that one of the ways that I keep talking about capitalism because it's real, but I think capitalism turns us into these static beings that are not changing. And I was talking to my partner the other day about how this winter, I live on Lenni Lenape land, also known as Union City, New Jersey, and it has been frighteningly cold. I can't even remember a cold season like this. And the care practices that I used last winter, my body's like rejecting. My body's like, we need something completely different to be with this new season. And so I think part of the care work inside of this is actually listening for, in this season of my life, what does my body need to be present, to show up for myself, to show up for my people, to show up inside of movement. And what it looks like right now, honestly, is I've been getting up at 5 a.m., which if you had told me that a couple of years ago, that's, you know, we change, right? That I would be a morning person, I would have laughed at you and been like, please go talk to somebody else. But getting up at 5 a.m., I have at least 2 hours where I start off doing my Odinani, which is the spiritual cosmology of Igbo people practices, which often comes with, you know, honoring of the ancestors in my lineage. I also do a meditation and then give some offerings back to the earth and just like really align with like, okay, who am I trying to be today? What have I forgotten? What do I need to remember? And then I move my body in some way just so that like more of me gets access to life and doesn't get, because, you know, once the day kicks off, I am in back-to-back calls and it can be really hard to engage movement, even though I try to sprinkle that in there. So yeah, getting up at 5 a.m., doing a number of like spiritual grounding practices that are connected to my lineage and also my people and my values feels really critical in this moment. And then also, one of the things that's been really, really grounding for me the last couple of years, I never thought it would be, is Muay Thai boxing. And I want to shout out my teachers across Thailand and also across New Jersey and New York. And it came to me at a time when I was really, really depressed, could not feel like my life force energy anymore. And my therapist at the time was like, stop the yoga. Stop like any kind of practice that's like bringing your system down. You really need to bring it up. And so what I love about Muay Thai and what I've learned from a lot of my teachers is just the focus on the body as sovereign. The body is sovereign and that we constantly get to choose how we show up, and we can show up powerfully in a really relaxed way. Regardless of like what's coming at you, you can choose how you respond. You can pay attention to your environment. And the person who is, quote unquote, bringing attacks, they're also bringing their own power. We actually retranslate and reclaim that to power meeting power. So how does power learn how to interact with another power? We learn a lot about our instincts and, you know, where we move towards harm or move towards connection inside of that. And it's been a really important practice for me. The third thing I'll say two more things. One is just constantly assessing my capacity. I'm the eldest child. I have lived in just like constant crisis my whole life. Still am living in different kinds of crisis. And so I have a big capacity to hold a lot. I've also often been a leader in most of the jobs that I've had, currently a leader in multiple organizations. And the love of my people is high. So when people ask me to do things, I'm like, yes, you know, if it feels in alignment, I will figure out a way to do it. And I think a lot of my work right now, because I get a lot of requests, is just really practicing discernment around what my capacity can sustain for the long haul. And knowing if I say no, it might be a no for right now and a yes later, or it might be no, but a friend of mine who's also part of an ecosystem can do this too. So really just getting more discerning about where my capacity is. The last thing I'll say is asking for more support. I think as leaders, particularly leading from a dark-skinned, non-binary body that's expected to give a lot, I think it is an important practice of leadership to let people in around where I need support and be like, I'm struggling today, y'all. I need you to hold me in these ways. I need us to partner and flank each other in these ways for this to get done. And yeah, that practice of vulnerable leadership, of revealing where else can I be held as I'm doing holding, feels also very, very important.
That's a really brave thing, right? Like, I think for any leader to sort of say and admit the spaces and places that you need support. And I'm sure the folks that you work with, your teams, probably really see that as this like beautiful. There is such an amazing benefit to being vulnerable, or being able to be vulnerable, I guess, in spaces where that is safe to do so.
Keyword safe to do so, because not all spaces yes. can hold it. And then that's information.
No.
You're like, okay, well.
Right. Learn that. Oh, okay. Not that one. Not that
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We have a different kind of relationship here.
Yeah. We're getting to the end of our conversation, which feels wild because I'm like, this went by so fast. And I know for a fact that Bridget and I could talk to you for hours and want to respect your time on it. So one of the things that we've been asking all of the guests this season is, what's one thing, I'm sure there are many, but what's one thing about trauma that the public might not know or understand? And what would change if they did?
That's such a good question. Well, I want to say I don't know what people don't know. And there are some patterns that I see that I get curious about. I think that particularly in an age of social media, we have a lot of language around trauma. Like, people are talking about trauma, I'm traumatized, you know. And I think that's beautiful. And I often wonder about, beyond the intellectual space, how much are people letting themselves feel the impact of trauma in their lives, you know, at a pace that works for them, you know? And I think a lot of the interventions within the wellness industrial complex with trauma are also very hyper-individualized. So it's like, go to this meditation retreat, do this bubble bath, sage your room, you know, sage yourself, sage the thoughts away. And I don't want to knock individual practices and how they resource people. I think we all need them in different ways, you know, whether that is like connecting with a plant or doing a practice or ritual that really supports how you are alive, or other things. Like, I think they're really important. And I think the scale of the violence and the scale of the traumas that we are all in collectively require collective healing and collective organizing in order for us to all move towards freedom and justice and possibility. And I think that the more we only hyper-focus on the individual, we leave so many people behind, and we just keep reinforcing a lot of these same conditions that are working really, really hard to harm us. And then I think one of the hardest things is that we get disconnected from each other. Like, we don't see and lean in on the symbiotic nature of our species. Like, that is an inherent thing to being human, is that we are an interdependent species with ourselves and each other and with the planet and the earth. And we need collective practice to move us all towards freedom. So that's my hope. That's my hope, is that as we continue to expand our conversations and our understanding of trauma, that we have more practice spaces to feel the impact on our bodies, to feel the possibility of healing, to heal together, and also to organize together for our sovereignty.
It's beautiful. And I just want to thank you for what you're doing. I really do believe that movements and organizing are collective acts of hope, right? For what can be in spite of what is. And you just gave us some really beautiful language, Adaku, around like how to think about that and feel it and use that as a powerful tool in how we can work to put more good into the world and make things better for everyone. And really grateful for your time and your energy today. You're doing so many things, and in that discernment, you trusted us to come have this conversation, and that feels, it's something I'm really grateful for, and I want to express that. And of course, we're always thankful for our listeners that tune in, and I hope they really got some beautiful nuggets today. And as you listen to season 4 of Traumatize, be sure you can subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. And thanks again for joining us today.
So grateful to be with y'all. Thanks again for inviting me and for everyone who listened.
This episode of Traumatize is over, but this podcast is just one of our many resources. Volare welcomes all survivors of crime and their supporters. So please visit us at volare-empowers.org to learn more about how to access our trauma education and how to partner with us to create empowering experiences for survivors.